said, my heart exalts in the Lord. My heart is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There's no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one besides you, nor is there any rock like our God. Boast no more, so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. The Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. The vows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who are full hire themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry cease to hunger. Even barren gives birth to seven, but she who has many children languishes. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap. To make them sit with nobles. Inherit a seat of honor. The pillars of the earth are the Lord's. And he set the world on them. He keeps the feet of his godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. For not by might shall man prevail. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed.
Duncan once said, "What price we pay for the glory of motherhood." I like that quotation because it highlights the paradox of motherhood. On the one hand, there is a glory to it, and on the other hand, there is a heavy price to it. There is a beauty and a glory, a joy about motherhood that is hard to compare to anything else. Even if you're not a mother, I'm not a mother, I'm a father, but being around mothers who cherish the job that they do, who understand the importance of it, you see the significance of it. And it is a glorious thing when it is done in the right way. But it's also a costly thing. Being a good mother, being a godly mother, you will pay a price that you cannot imagine going into. There is a level of commitment. There is a level of sacrifice that you have to make. And if you're not willing to make those, it will affect the outcome. There are sorrows that come with it. There are struggles that come with it. There are challenges that come with it. And so, indeed, it is a glorious thing, but it is a costly thing as well. When motherhood is done well, there is not much in this world that can match its beauty. And the story I want to talk about today from the Bible comes from 1 Samuel chapters 1 and 2. And it highlights the story of a woman who did it remarkably well. The story of Hannah, who is Samuel's mother, I think presents us with a great model of motherhood. We don't have a lot of information about Hannah. We only have about 1.5 chapters worth of information. We have the basic story about how she eventually had Samuel. We have about 10 or 11 verses, which are called the Psalm of Hannah. And then near the end of chapter 2, we've got a couple of other comments made about her and just sort of the follow-up to the story. And that's all we have. And yet, in those few verses of information, we have a marvelous story. And so I'd like to talk this morning about the story of Hannah, and Hannah particularly modeling for us what godly motherhood ought to look like. When you think about the story of Hannah, first of all, I want to suggest that she was a model of faith. Her situation is described in the first 8 verses of 1 Samuel chapter 1. Now, there's a lot of names and places in the opening verses. We're told that there was a certain man from Ramathaim Zophim, from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephraimite. And he had 2 wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And if you were to stop the story there, you've got quite a significant story. you have a sort of a love triangle, not really sort of, kind of. It's a bad situation. You can read two verses and figure that one out. But there's a man here by the name of Elkanah, and he lived about 15 miles from Shiloh. Shiloh, back during the period of the Judges, was the place where the tabernacle had been erected. And it was situated there. If you wanted to go and make sacrifices, that's where you would go. He lived about 15 miles from there. He's called an Ephraimite in this text, but if you go over to a passage in 1 Chronicles chapter 6, he's actually listed as a Levite. We don't know for sure, but it appears that by his family lineage, he was of the tribe of Levi, and he belonged particularly to the clan of Kohathites, which meant that he would have been qualified to serve in the temple. We know that Samuel eventually does serve in the temple, not only as a prophet and a judge, but also as a priest. So it makes sense that the account in 1 Chronicles 6 is accurate. But the fact that he's mentioned as an Ephraimite may simply suggest the place where he lived. Remember that throughout the land of Israel, there were certain cities that were designated to the Levites. Since they did not have their own land for possession, each tribe had to allot a certain number of cities, and that may well have been the case with this man, Elkanah. We're told that he had two wives. That wasn't all that uncommon back in those days. We know some prominent biblical characters that had multiple wives. Solomon won the count. He won the prize for having the most. David, his father, had several. But don't forget, Abraham had a wife and a concubine, or a handmaid, whatever you want to call her. And Jacob had two wives. So there were a number of good men in Old Testament times who had multiple wives. And it may have something to do with the fact that his favored wife, Elkanah's favored wife, the one he loved, and we're told that specifically, that he loved Hannah, but she was barren. So it might have even been at her request. Maybe she did something like what Sarah did. Sarah suggested to Abraham, "Abraham, look, you can't have a child through me, so have it through my handmaid." Maybe that's what happened. We don't really know a lot of details. When we get to the story, he has two wives, one of them has children, and one of them doesn't, and that's never a good thing. I don't care if it's a biblical story or a made-for-TV movie, it's just not a good thing. So that's the situation that Hannah is in with her family. They are a godly family, at least for the most part. His other wife has some issues, and we'll get to that in a moment. But Elkanah appears to be a godly man. I've seen several commentaries that kind of throw him under the bus and seem to suggest that he wasn't a very caring man. I beg to differ. The information that we have suggests that he was a good man. Every year, we're told that he would go up from his city to worship, verse 3, and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there, were priests to the Lord there. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah and his wife and to all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb. So Elkanah is a godly man. And by and large, they as a family appear to be godly. At least once a year, they go up as a family to Shiloh, to the place where they were to offer sacrifices, and they do so. I don't know if this was just a personal decision that they made every year, or if they were simply, if this is a reference to one of the three annual feasts that all Jewish men were required to go to. I think it's significant that not only did Elkanah do it, but also his family did it as well. So here's a man who regularly worshiped God. He regularly sacrificed to God. He did it on behalf of his family. He gave them material things to bless them. He took care of both wives. He took care of the children involved. So Elkanah appears to be a pretty good man. But then the problem kicks in. We're told that her rival, Hannah's rival, Peninnah, the other wife, would, however, provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. Twice in two verses, we're told that the Lord had closed her womb. I don't know why. We're not given any indication that it was punishment. We're not really told why it was. Maybe there was a lesson he was trying to teach her. I don't really know. Doesn't say. But God is the one, we're told, who closed the womb of Hannah. She could not have children because of some decision that God made. She's not privy to that information. Elkanah is not privy to that information. And I don't think Peninnah would have cared. In her mind, this was an occasion for glory. Having children in those days was tied up completely with a woman's identity. If she couldn't have children, it was a bad thing. And you see that periodically in some of the reactions of people to pregnancy. When Sarah got pregnant, remember what happened to her? She laughed. I just can't believe it. You remember what Elizabeth did when she became pregnant? She hid herself. And she said, well, this is the way that God has chosen to take away my reproach. That's how bad a thing it was not to have children. Peninnah took full advantage of the situation and tries to make her miserable, and she succeeds. It says a lot about Peninnah. It happened year after year, verse 7, that as they went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. And then here's Elkanah trying to comfort her. Hannah, why do you weep and do not eat, and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? Every husband has tried to argue that with their wives at some point. And I've seen commentaries that just run him through and say, how utterly insensitive of him. I think the man was trying to comfort his wife. I think that's all he was trying to do. And what he says is absolutely true. He was a good man who took care of his wife and took care of his family. And you can't fault him for that. I realize there are sometimes we have wounds as husbands and wives that not even the spouse, no matter how loving they are, no matter how helpful they are, there will be wounds, there will be injuries there will be emotions there that the other one can't fully understand. But you know what? We still try to care anyway. And I'll say this about a lot of men. A lot of husbands sometimes don't give their wives the support that they should. Now, in this case, there was another woman, legitimately, in Elkanah's life. It was his other wife. But his preference was for Hannah. Sometimes we men allow other people or other things to occupy the place that our wife should have in our lives. Sometimes we love our jobs more than we love our wives. Some men love sports more than they love their wives. Some men love their TVs more than they love their wives. Some men love their children more than they love their wives. And sadly, some men love other women more than they love their own wives. That's not the case with Elkanah. Elkanah did everything he could to provide a good home and to comfort Hannah in her affliction, but there was a hole there that not even he could fulfill. There was a place that was just empty, and despite his best intentions, he couldn't help with it. After the offerings are made, we're told in verse 9 that Hannah rose after that. I wanted to mention something. This point is about her faith. She's depressed. There is an emptiness in her life. But I want you to notice she never stopped worshiping God. Every year, she went with her family. And I want you to notice she did this. They did this together. And I want you to notice that after these events in verse 9, she went to the temple or the tabernacle and prayed. She prayed. She made a vow. She worshiped. There is an empty spot in her life, but she never abandoned God. I can't tell you how many times I have met people, they seem very zealous for the Lord, but the first time something bad happens, or if there is a problem that persists in their life, they just give up. Well, I don't know why God would let this happen. Hannah didn't know why the Lord had let this happen. She, I don't think, is even aware that the Lord had caused this. But she never gave up. In spite of a bad, ugly family situation, her faith persisted. She is a model of faith in very, very difficult times. She's also a model of prayer. And that's largely what we think about when we think about Hannah. Verse 9, she rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Eli the priest is sitting on a seat by the doorpost of the temple. She, greatly distressed, prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. Now, verse 11 is terse. It gets to the point. This is not an elaborate flowery prayer. It is an earnest prayer. But she is straight to the point. She says, she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. Now, she made a bargain. There's really no other way to say it. She made a bargain with the Lord regarding a child she didn't even have. But I'm going to say this. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. As long as you follow through on your bargain, what's bad about it? Isn't that what the concept of Old Testament vows was about? You would make a vow to the Lord. There would be a special period of dedication. There would be special sacrifices offered. When you think about bargaining with the Lord, do you remember Abraham's prayer or bargain or salesmanship with God concerning the city of Sodom and Gomorrah? I'm going to go destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, Lord, suppose there's 50 people. Suppose there's 40. And he whittled it down, doesn't he? That was bargaining, but in the best possible sense. He was concerned about the well-being of others. Jesus prayed, Lord, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. There's nothing wrong with asking God exactly what you want. And that's exactly what she did. She wanted a child in the worst way. And she bluntly requested of God and says, God, if you will give this child to me, he will belong to you. That was the substance of her prayer. Not very flowery, not very eloquent, but awfully earnest and awfully powerful. She prayed to God in the most difficult of circumstances. It is awfully hard to pray when life is hard, isn't it? So when life is hard, what that means is we have to pray harder. She is a wonderful model of how to pray in a no-win situation. In her mind, look, this is my only choice. I think it had been her only choice for a long time. I don't think this is the first time she prayed to God about this. From what I can tell of her and her character, this is something that had been on her mind and in her prayers for a very long time. And so she models for us a prayer that a life of faith. It's interesting here. I'm not really sure how to understand this. When Eli sees her praying, she prays in verse 11. Verse 12 says, it came about as she continued praying. So she continues asking this business about having a child. Verse 12, Eli is watching her mouth. She was speaking in her heart, but her lips were moving. Her voice was not heard, so Eli thought she was drunk. She was having a stoplight moment. Have you ever noticed that some people, when they're sitting at stoplights, are talking and there's nobody else in the car? Their lips are moving. There's no one there. My wife says I have a lot of those moments and they're not even at stoplights. Somebody noticed here when I lived up in Iowa, a woman, she didn't ask me, she asked my wife. She said, I noticed that sometimes when Floyd gets up in the pulpit and in those few moments before he starts preaching, his mouth is moving but nothing's coming out. Is he okay? I guess I'm rehearsing. I don't know. I was not even aware of it. But anyway, she was having a stoplight moment. Her mouth was moving. Words are not coming out. And he made a judgment about her like we do about people at stoplights and preachers up in the pulpit that move their mouths and nothing. That guy's nuts. There's something wrong with this woman. Actually, she was very fervently praying. It was a silent prayer. And she was so engaged, her mouth was moving. But I think this is kind of interesting. How often did Eli think this about people? That's what gives me. Was it so common that people came to the sanctuary and prayed drunk that he thought, oh, this lady must be drunk? That's the first thing that comes to his mind. Now, I'll tell you what. When you read much further, or if you read back a little ways in the book of Judges, you read a little bit further in the book of Samuel, these were bad times, and it wasn't good times for the priesthood. So maybe this is a commentary on her righteousness as opposed to how ungodly so many people were in that day. The priest, just the first explanation that pops in his mind is this lady's drunk. Well, anyway, she's praying, and she explains, "No, my Lord, I'm a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul to the Lord." Have you ever prayed like that? Ever prayed like that? Let me tell you something else about her prayer life. She was not afraid to be seen in earnest prayer. What she was doing was public. It was at the doorway or somewhere in the tabernacle courtyard. Not really sure exactly where. But it was where she could be seen. And she was so absorbed in her prayers that it didn't really matter to her if anybody saw her or not. And some people did see her and they misconstrued it. That's the kind of confidence we ought to have in prayer, that we will pray anywhere under any circumstances, regardless of what anyone else thinks of us. Even if it means that our prayers and our actions may be misconstrued. One of my favorite pictures from Norman Rockwell is the picture of the woman and the boy praying in a restaurant. They're about to eat their meal, and they bow their heads and they pray. And what's most interesting of all is the reaction of everybody else. They're pointing, they're whispering, they're grinning, they're laughing. Wow, they're praying in public. What an oddity. She wasn't afraid to do that. And in that, I think she provides us with a model of godly prayer. I'll have to bring it up. It's not working. Integrity. She is a model of integrity. The Lord answers her prayer. We're told basically that Eli ends the conversation, verse 17, "Go in peace, may the God of Israel grant your petition." She says, "Let your maidservant find your favor in your sight." One of the interesting things is her attitude that is shown all through this. In verse 11, when she prays to God three times, she talks about her being the maidservant of God. And twice in conversation with Eli, she refers to herself as being the maidservant of Eli. She had a very humble disposition. Well, the Lord grants her her request. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Here again is a picture of a basically godly family. They go there to worship. They have the formal worship. They have the sacrifices. And before they go back home, they have another period of family worship. They returned again to their house in Ramah. Elkanah had relations with his wife, Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. And it came about in due time, after Hannah had conceived, that she gave birth to a son, and she named him Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked him of the Lord." And in verse 21, the family annual ritual resumes. Now, if that's a straightforward chronology, sometime shortly after she got home, she gets pregnant. So 9 months later, she has a baby, and just shortly after that, it's time to go back to Shiloh. Now, more time may have elapsed. I don't know if she immediately got pregnant. I don't know if this is the very next year that they go up to Shiloh. It may be a couple of years later. Don't really know. But she has the child. The family gets ready to go, and she says, "No, I'm not going to go this time. I'm going to keep him here, and when he gets weaned, I will take him up, and he won't come home with us." I'll tell you what, that had to have been a tough decision for Mama. That's exactly what she promised to God. But she knew the implications. I don't think she's hedging. The boy needed to be weaned. The boy could not be left with someone until he was ready to leave. Weaning in Old Testament times generally took about 3 years, sometimes a little bit longer. So roughly about 3 years, maybe four, maybe a little bit more pass. And the boy is taken to Shiloh, to the tabernacle. The man Elkanah went up. Hannah did not go, verse 22. And it's interesting to me, here again is a picture of the integrity of Elkanah. Be careful not to trash the man, but he's a pretty good fellow. He says, "Do what seems best to you. Remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word." Don't forget the vow in all of this. She remembers it. He remembers it. This is a picture of a godly family. So she stays there. And verse 24 says, "When she had weaned him, she took him up with her with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young." The word that's used here is Nahar, and Nahar meant a very young boy. So he is a boy when he is taken there. I'll tell you what, that must have been hard on her. And yet she doesn't exhibit any hesitancy about it whatsoever. Here was a woman of her word. She made a promise to God, and she kept it. And the promise didn't just involve her. It involved her children. And it didn't just involve her child. It involved the very life and future of her child. That is integrity. She brings these sacrifices, and the text either says, it's kind of hard to figure out what the text means, either there were 3 1-year-old bulls or there was 1 3-year-old bull. The text is a little bit ambiguous. And she brings along an ephah of flour, half a bushel, that was a fairly sizable amount, and a jug of wine. She reiterates the vows. Verse 26, 27, look at how she brings this up. She first of all sees Eli. They bring the sacrifices to him, verse 25. And she said, "Oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord." So she reminds him, "I'm the woman who was here before, and I've come back to keep my word." And it's also an implicit acknowledgement that the Lord had answered her prayers. She wants everyone to know this was of the Lord. This came about as a result of the Lord's blessing, and I'm honoring what I said. And then she said, "For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition, which I asked of him." She acknowledges the power of God and the graciousness of God. And then finally, verse 28, she says, "The reason I'm here today is to dedicate him to the Lord. I have dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there." And the "he" there, I think, is a reference to Samuel from that point onward. She says, "I have brought him here. I have dedicated him to the Lord." She dedicated that child long before he was ever born, long before he was ever conceived. And let me tell you something, women, you want to be a godly mother, that's the mentality you have to have. That's the mentality you have to have. Before your children are ever born, they belong to the Lord. When your children are born, they belong to the Lord. As your children grow, they belong to the Lord. And when your children leave home, whether it's at a young age or whether you can't get them out of the house at 40, it doesn't matter. They belong to the Lord. And she did not balk one bit on that. In fact, I read in that an element of pride, not the bad kind, the good kind, an element of satisfaction. My son belongs to the Lord. Who else would he belong to? In her mind, that was so obvious. So here's a woman of great integrity. Her son was dedicated to the Lord before he was ever even conceived. And as he grew, and as that moment of reality came when she actually had to take him and turn him over to the temple or to the tabernacle for actual service, she did not hesitate at all. We dedicate our children to something. Your child is dedicated to something. Now, you may not have made a formal issue about it. There might not have been a ceremony, but before your children were born, in your mind, they were dedicated to someone or something. And as your children grow up, they are dedicated to someone or something. Who they're dedicated to, what they're dedicated to, depends a lot on what we show them, what we say to them, what we demonstrate in our own lives to them. I think it's remarkable. Samuel proves to be one of the truly outstanding men of the Old Testament. He was a bright light in a very dark time, in a very dark place. But he shone forth, and I'm going to tell you what, it's largely because of the influence of his mother. But what really gets me is when she turned him over to be raised by Eli and to be raised in the tabernacle, he was a boy. And yet, he was already dedicated to the Lord, largely because of her influence. The first 4 or 5 years of your child's life are most important. saying that after that point things can't change. I'm not saying after that point there's no longer any hope or any instruction or anything like that. But those first 3, 4, 5, 6 years, those are critical. And parents, you need to lay a foundation in those years, because those foundations that you lay will be with them for the rest of their lives. That's when they're going to learn the concept of accountability. That's when they will learn the concept of owning up to their mistakes. The idea that there are some things that are permissible and some things that are not permissible, and there are consequences to both. If you don't teach them the consequences now, when do you plan on teaching them that? If you don't teach them respect for adult authority at that early age, when will they learn it? You know, even a toddler, when they're rebellious, there's a little bit of cuteness, but when they turn about 20 and they're still that way, it's not very cute. It's a little bit repulsive. No, it's a whole lot repulsive. What they learn when they're little is so critical and so vitally important. When she said that Samuel was dedicated to the Lord, it had already been that way for a long time. This was just the official party that recognized it. She was a woman of integrity. Her great humility, her dependence on the Lord, keeping her word and keeping her priorities. Tell me that she was a woman of great integrity, and it serves as a model for that. And then she is a model of joy. I am sure that she was overwhelmingly happy the day that Samuel was born. But when was her song uttered? When did she sing this great song? This was read for us earlier in 1 Samuel chapter 2. The first 10 verses is what we call Hannah's song. It's a song of victory. It's a song about the power of God. It's a song about how God... Now, I want you to notice that earlier, for the very first time in the Bible, back in 1 Samuel chapter 1, we're told in verse 3, that Elkanah and his family went up to Shiloh to worship the Lord of hosts. First place in the Bible where he is called that. And when Hannah prayed to God in verse 11 of chapter 1, she called him the Lord of hosts, the Lord of God's army. And so it's suitable then that when you get to chapter 2, there's a lot of military imagery there. He is the captain of the host. He is the Lord of hosts. He is the ruler of the heavenly armies. And much of the language of this chapter is the Lord as a great military victor. The first three verses of chapter 2 exalt in God, in the Lord and his salvation. She rejoices in the victory of God over his enemies and her enemies. And she warns those who are boastful and arrogant, don't do that before the Lord because he will put you in his place. And then in verses 4 through 8, she talks about the works of God. And the theme in this whole section is the idea of reversal of fortune. He takes the powerful and brings them down. He takes the humble and lifts them up. He takes the childless and makes them fruitful. He takes the arrogant and humbles them. He takes those who are hungry and makes them full. He takes those who are full and makes them hungry. Only the Lord of hosts can do that, and she acknowledges it. Implicit in this is in verse 5, even the barren gives birth to 7, and she who has many children languishes. She's saying, God made me fruitful. She acknowledges that in her song. And the last part deals with the judgments of God. Be careful how you mess with God. Be careful that you don't mess with God, because he will judge you. To his righteous, he will judge righteously and faithfully. To those who are wicked, he will punish them accordingly. Great song. When did she sing this song? Not the day he was born, but the day that she gave up her son. That would be hard for me. But that tells joy. For her to see her son go and serve the Lord, even if he couldn't be with her, that was her highest joy. Is that your highest joy for your children, to see them walking with the Lord? It ought to be. We have a way of sending mixed signals to our kids. Now, kids, the most important thing is, have you ever said that to your kids? Now, the most important thing is, go get your degree. The most important thing is, get a good job. The most important thing is, marry someone sensible. The most important thing, and we can fill that in with a lot of things. No, the most important thing is, you get your life right with God. That's the most important thing, and beyond that, I couldn't care less. You take care of that, most everything else will be taken care of. I know there are other tough decisions that have to be made about jobs and careers and marriage, but you worry about that first. And that's the kind of woman that Hannah was. She rejoiced. She sang a song when her son left home. We talk about that a lot around our household. What are we going to do when the kids leave? We're already working on the song. You're going to have three verses. Verse one's already done, more or less, kind of, sort of. Although when they get married, they start bringing people back with them. I've heard that. No, in all seriousness, the day we took Hannah to college, we cried. In August, when the baby leaves, we're going to cry. We've cried a lot already. But I'll say this. As long as they are following the Lord, that's all I care about. And I'm not even a mother. We had a lot of prayers about it, a lot of conversations about it, a lot of tears about it. A lot of worries about it. But I want to imitate. I want to imitate Hannah's joy. The day her son left home to serve the Lord, that was the happiest day of her life. And the story doesn't end there. We're told that year after year she came back, and every year she brought him a robe. I guess he grew every year. So she brings him a new robe. And the Lord eventually blessed her with more sons and more daughters. But this is a remarkable woman. You want to have a good Mother's Day? Have a Mother's Day like Hannah. Be the kind of woman that she was. Have the kind of priorities that she had. Have the kind of faith and the kind of prayer life and the kind of integrity and the kind of joy. And I'll say this, there are women who are just like Hannah in terms of their personal godly integrity. And sometimes the story doesn't have the happy ending that it did with Samuel. Sometimes our hearts are still broken despite our best efforts to raise our children in a godly family, in a godly way. But what we learn from Hannah is no matter what, we still put our trust in the Lord. He is still the Lord of hosts. He still rules this world. And he can still take the afflicted and raise them up, and he can take the mighty and bring them down. He is the Lord all-powerful. So no matter what circumstances we're dealing with, there is a place of joy, a place of faith, a place where we can be what we ought to be, a place where we can always take our concerns and prayers, and it is before the Lord of hosts. That is the kind of woman that Hannah was. Honoré de Balzac, who was a 19th century French novelist, said the art of motherhood involves much silent, unobtrusive self-denial, an hourly devotion which finds no detail too minute. That's the kind of mother I picture. She paid the kind of mother I think of with regard to Hannah. She paid attention to a lot of details, and she sweated the details because she knew how important they were. You're here this morning, and your life isn't the kind of life that it ought to be, it is never too late to turn back to the Lord. Maybe your family life hasn't turned out the way that you'd like for it to. Maybe it's not your family life. Maybe it's some other aspect of your life. Maybe your family's good, but other things aren't so good. You know what? It doesn't matter. You turn it over to the Lord and let him resolve it. help you in any way in your spiritual life, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.